Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast. Today I'm speaking with the outstanding UK ceramic artist, the Reverend Jane Shepherd, whose work explores the magical, mysterious, and sacred aspects of human experience. Rooted in the ancient meditative practice of coiling, her vessels and smoke-fired forms evoke ritual, memory, and our deep connection to the earth. A member of the Craft Potters Association and Homo Faber Guide, Jane has received multiple awards and exhibited widely across the UK. Her pieces feel timeless, quiet, powerful objects that call to our shared humanity. I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation. Let's meet Jane. Jane, thank you so much for joining us on the Color and Ceramics podcast. I am thrilled that you're here, mostly because I love your work and I love your stories. And so thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's so kind of you. Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate being here.
Oh, awesome. I wanted to talk about three things as we have a conversation today. One is this idea that you are honoring the ancient peoples on Earth, and you do that through a focus on your coiling technique, I think, if I got that right. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about how you think and how that emerges in your work. You are, of course, an interfaith minister and did some art therapy in the past. And so would love to talk about how that plays itself out in your notion, because I know you kind of explore the human experience through your work. And so that would be great. And of course, you make beautiful vessels. I love your big round forms and some of your newer sculptural pieces. And so I would love to chat about those things. And so that's given our listeners a sense of you, but I wondered if you could talk a little bit about your journey in clay and what got you here today.
Yes, of course. And it's still a bit of a mystery. and I've heard of a few of your podcasts, and I think there's a fairly common experience of my mother was in her, when she was at college, she did sculpture. So, and she was then an art teacher. So I guess I was versed in crafts from when I was really very young. And I was also blessed with living in Cambridge. It being a university town, and there are some absolutely extraordinary museums. So the Fitzwilliam Museum, and also there's an anthropology museum too, which had a really fabulous collection of artifacts from around the world. So there was lots of indigenous art, big totem poles. I mean, really, just amazing artwork, often with symbolism and meaning. And I used to, by the time I was about 16, 18, I was in town. I was doing my A-levels and I was doing art, as I was always interested in art, and then spent all of my free time going around these museums, drawing and just being intrigued by each object, some of which were just tiny things to be held in your hand, But they obviously opened up different cultures, different ways of thinking, but also different ways of viewing the world and different approaches to materials and aesthetics. So there was a whole diverse opening going on. I don't think I realized how much that would have an impact on me, really. So, but I then took the trajectory. I loved art, but I was more graphics based, I think. Very interested in the forms of lettering, so calligraphy, balance and form, and but obviously already steeped in sculpture from my mum in Henry Moore and Barbara Hepworth particularly, so more local artists. And then I trained as a teacher, a primary teacher, but I did art and religious studies as my main subjects. And we had different lessons in different areas of art. So it was like a foundation course, which was all fantastic and quite familiar territory. It was all great, but I have to say, when it came to ceramics, I was terrified. The thought of working 3D, because most of my work was kind of desk bound and very interested in the curvy linear structures, but in a very flat form. So being terrified and knowing I had it coming up, I thought, well, the only way around this is to get some practice in, outside of time. So I enrolled in an evening class, and the very first class I did, the woman who, and I can't remember who she was, but I remember being given the clay and being given a very rudimentary instruction as to how to coil. And I made a really large pot in 2 hours. That was about 18 inches high and really very rough and ready. But it was so extraordinary. And right there, I knew that that was what I wanted to do. And that was it, really. So I just carried on that journey, never really being at all interested in learning how to use the wheel. I did, because later I became a ceramics teacher. So I needed to learn all of those principles. But it was coiling, hooked by coiling right from the very start.
Yeah, it's interesting. And talking with people from around the world, how many people have the same process, I guess, of getting hooked somehow on clay. And once you get your fingers into it, it's hard to let it go.
The familiarity of it, I think there's something in that material and that tactile nature. And yes, I've heard that in some of your podcasts. It just grabs you. It's so familiar. It's really ingrained.
Very visceral, isn't it? Like we clay is of the earth, right? And we are of the earth. And in a way, it seems to me we connect with the earth when we do this kind of clay work.
Totally. And that's the basis of my work, the simplicity of that, but also how much of it you're then open to. And that relation, the human relationship with clay obviously goes back almost as far as we do. And so it's really in our DNA. And I think in some small level, that's what that first day, that's what I was responding to. It's that knowledge in my DNA that this is such a familiar material. But it's more than that, it's the process as well, because particularly with coiling, when you're working with those really basic processes, and that is, pinching and coiling are as simple as it gets. And there's an immediate connection with ancestry there, because you know that so many thousand people before you have been using that same technique and working in the same way as yourself. It's like an immediate transportation.
It's very interesting. I was recently in Turkey and visiting some of the ancient sites there and was struck with the, I guess it was my connection in some ways with the people who had come before me, right? I remember sitting in a Roman amphitheater that had been built thousands of years ago, and I was there by myself. There was nobody but me sitting out in this thing out in the countryside. And it was interesting to start to feel a connection with people who had sat where I sat and touched what I was touching. And I think, in a way, that's what you're talking about as well.
Yes, something very similar to that. Yes, it's like an immediacy in the physical.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you were a teacher, so you were working physically with those kids all the time. And are you still teaching? What's your what are you
I
doing
do
these days?
still teach. Yes, and I'd like to do more actually. I teach what I loved. So I taught general with young children to begin with. But I did a lot of art with them. And then I moved into adult education. And then that was beautiful because I was working with adults who hadn't done art since they were at school. So there was the kind of judgment and all those surrounding things that were affecting them and impeding their process. So I did that kind of access-based work. And then teamed up with an art therapist to deliver a foundation course, which then I was this, she would deliver all the theoretical component, and I did all the studio practice. And a lot of that then was either drawing or working in a simple way with other materials. But then I realized that clay obviously has, there's an immediacy with clay and a versatility with clay that enables you to for it to become a really helpful expressive tool. But now, so I teach beginners just basic hand building techniques just to bring them into the process. And then I teach coiling master classes. And I'm starting to build in some retreat sessions as well, which are an opportunity for artists and practitioners to kind of reboot using the material in a more playful and open way.
When you say reboot, what
Yeah.
do you mean by that? What are they rebooting from, and where are they going with that?
Well, I guess that depends on them. But I think at heart, I do recognize as a practitioner that there can be, we can get in a bit of a rut, particularly if there's a degree of commercial success to your work. There is that thing in there about the repeat. And for me, you know, I'm getting more and more engaged with that. What's creativity all about? And my work is all about a minimal approach. And it is like the antithesis of mass production. So it's a call to kind of sit in and review our practice, I think. Maybe in a slightly ethical way, but in a softer way than that, in a gentler, more enabling way.
So really, it's I guess what you're saying is helping people get in touch with what's important to them, what's driving them in the work, rather than
Absolutely.
thinking about it as what might sell or what might somebody like, or
Yes.
how many likes do I get on
Oh, totally.
Instagram versus what's in my heart.
Exactly. Yeah. What's the invitation? What am I being drawn to make? And what's stopping me making?
And have you got a story of somebody who had a eureka moment in one of those classes where they're rebooting?
That's a good question. I'm not sure that I can provide a story like that, partly because I hold those things in confidence. But definitely, people go have gone away from my classes with really reevaluating what their process is, particularly people who throw.
Why
Yeah.
so, do you think? Why is it that the throwers do more evaluation than the hand builders, maybe?
I think because it's a cultural thing, I recognize that in some parts of the world, throwing isn't so much about speed and productivity. But I think it is here. There, I think there is some a tradition of economically, you know, how many bowls can I produce in an hour? You know, that's the challenge. How much can I make? And then how many can I glaze? And then how much, and can I sell them really cheap at this, for production value? And I have had people really stop and go, that's it. I'm just, this isn't, it's not right what I'm doing.
Not right for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's really cool. 'Cause I do think we get, or I guess I feel like I can get trapped up into some of those ideas that I create myself. I mean, it's not that anybody else is telling me what to do, and that these rules or expectations that I have can take me down a path. And then sometimes I'm in one now, sort of saying, hey, just a minute, Bob, what are you doing? Why are you doing what you're doing? What's important, and what's the best way to communicate that to others? Yeah.
It's difficult, isn't it? It's difficult when there's an economic need, when you need to make money from your work. I think that makes it particularly challenging. How do I address that with integrity? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure there. Now, we've talked a little bit about the coiling technique, and I'm not sure everybody who's listening knows about your process or how to do that. Could you talk a little bit about coiling and why you chose coiling? Or maybe it chose you, I'm not sure.
Yeah, a bit of both. It's the simplicity of coiling. Coiling in essence is just creating like a thin snake of clay and building up layer by layer so that each one of those is joined. And there are many different approaches to that. Some people will build up in a spiraling method and then join them. Some people almost do a combination of slabbing, so they will make a sort of snake, a sausage of clay, and then roll it flat and then join those incrementally so that in stages you're building a structure. So there are lots of variants of all of those things, and I talk about those in my classes. For me, I think I was taught right from the beginning, and it suited me to work. Rather than in a spiral, an upgoing spiral, to work layer by layer by layer for control. And it is just as simple as that. So each layer is then joined with my thumb, and then I move on to the next layer, and the next layer, and the next layer until it becomes a homogeneous wall. So that's the theory of it. It's really simple. It's enormously versatile, though, because you can create any structure from coiling. You can make it sharp-edged, you can make it really soft, you can make it symmetrical, you can make something that's asymmetrical, really loose and unstructured. You've got endless possibilities. The only thing that really stops you is the clay itself, the structural capacity of the clay. And so it needs to be able to hold its own strength. And so that's when your discipline and the attention comes in. So you're learning about the how to control the clay by recognizing its qualities and the dryness, and which then alerts you to the atmosphere, to the temperature in the room, to your own temperature, and it goes on and on and on. So then it can become a practice of mindfulness very, very quickly. Because you
Absolutely.
learn by your mistakes.
Absolutely. The word patience comes to mind as I'm listening to you talk, right? And
Totally.
I think if anything, I've been given the opportunity to learn patience by engaging with clay. So I hear you say that with that. Like, you can get excited about the shape as it's coming up, but if you're not paying attention to the strength, integrity of the clay underneath, it'll just flop onto the table for you.
Totally,
Yeah.
yes. And that's all that time wasted,
Yeah,
essentially.
yeah, yeah, yeah. And back into the bin goes the clay.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool. Now, in your journey in clay, you also became an interfaith minister.
Yes.
So I'd love to talk a little bit about that and how that plays itself out in the clay.
That's a fairly recent thing in my life. I was ordained in 2018 as an interfaith minister. So it was a very intensive training. And I have lots of wonderful conversations about it because it's a concept that a lot of people are unfamiliar with, and to be honest, I was unfamiliar with at the time. So I've always been very interested in religion as a subject. I think I've sat outside of a faith path, if you like, always been very interested in ancient spiritual practice from around the globe, and drawn to a simple way of living. So when I heard about interfaith ministry, I had a real visceral response to it, actually. And so I embarked on the training, and it's a kind of multi-faith. Really, the whole interfaith movement was set up with an idea to learning about different religions, learning about their commonality, learning about where the differences lay in order to broaden people's ability to listen and respect. And obviously, it was, the particular branch that I came to started off in America and then came over to the UK. But it was a very intensive training and a very, so it involved a lot of reading of sacred texts, but so some being the ancient and very established religions, and some more modern religious practices. So looking at spirituality in a wider way. And then learning how to put that into ritual and ceremony. So really, it's a lot of listening, a lot of really deep listening to people and meeting people in an individual way rather than assigning them into a sort of a global, I suppose it's a way to examine prejudice, really. So when I came out of that training and my ordination, I embarked on end of life care and funerals. And there's enormous privilege to doing funeral work and working with the bereaved and conversations with people about death, their own mortality. There's so many areas around that. So really fascinating stuff. So I did a lot of end of life care, but at the time, my boys were sort of late teens, early late teens, so they needed me, and I recognised that to do that work effectively and to maintain it, you do need to be really well supported in that work. So I made a decision to put that to one side in an overt way. And to really focus on the clay. But of course, clay, just working with it as a material, brings out so much about life. So it's a wonderful vehicle to have conversations with people where we just really simply engage with the clay, or even just talk about clay and what it brings up for them. So that's fantastic. So that's really how I'm using it at the moment. You mentioned urns, and I have made urns for people, and I'm still open to doing that. It's a wonderful thing to do. I mean, that's a real privilege to do. But I've find now that just engaging with material and just people's response to my work and when they're touching the work, that's all that's needed, really, because that's such an amazing vehicle. And I'm open to whatever that brings, but that's where it lies. So that's a really kind of natural synthesis of the two that wasn't engineered, but I'm relaxing into it and actually finding that it's very beneficial and seems to work. It's a natural marriage of material and process.
Yeah, it's interesting how our experiences, from yours, from art therapy and focusing on ancient peoples and religion and ministry, all end up being synthesized into our touch of clay. And in way it is. I'm holding my hand out as we're talking here, but it is kind of like the that's really important is when we touch things. It's the the texture, almost more than the color, begins to speak to people as we rub our hands on pieces.
It really does. And I think you probably feel that. I'm blessed that I'm touching clay all the time. And because I've worked with craft materials all my life anyway, I'm very familiar with touch. But I'm often surprised just how many people don't have that engagement with materials. So touch is a much less, well, they just experience it much less. They're not really engaged, and they're not using that as a vehicle. So it's not the sensory process of touch evokes so many other things. There's an opening that comes with touch, I think, that is very, very immediate. Yeah, it's powerful.
Absolutely. I think we get wrapped up in our visual senses and our auditory senses to an extreme degree compared to touch. And I sort of am thinking about that. We have a couple of little kids behind us, and they might go, "Ooh, yuck," when they touch something, right? And that's cool too, right? Being able to be aware of that sensation.
Really is. And you're reminding me now of well, probably about 20 years ago when I was teaching, and things started to change. And I had a few students of about 16 who were presenting with sort of obsessive compulsive disorder, and showing a real resistance to doing any of the studio-based practice. So actually coming to me terrified in advance of doing ceramic sessions. I'm just saying, I cannot do this. I cannot get my hands dirty. It was very, very strong. Yes. And so working with those students, and I'm really mindful of one student I did who then I just sort of got her to wear latex gloves initially, so that she could engage with it, but there'd be a barrier. But she worked through that, and it was so exciting. And for her, that was a massive breakthrough because it was real dirt as far as she. So
You
it
bet.
was the real deal. So that was really, really strong. And to then work through that and feel safe to construct and actually get to a point of enjoying the feeling was really quite remarkable. Yeah, very
Yes,
beautiful.
that would be. I was a psychologist in my previous life, and so worked with lots of people with OCD and anxiety challenges in their life. And so I understand exactly what you're talking about, of that deep-seated and very visceral fear that they would have in touching something that they perceive as dirty. And
Yeah.
so yeah, absolutely. That's very cool that you were able to help her move
Yeah.
through that.
Yes. That was really beautiful.
Absolutely. Now let's talk about your work. So we've talked about the ministry and some of your ideas around the spirit, how it gets there. Can we talk a little bit about the work itself? And so you've made beautiful, large, round forms, vessels, and some newer, I don't know what to call them. You can tell me, sculptural pieces. So tell us about your works, and try to do it in a way so that the people who are listening to this can try to get a sense of your work.
I will try, although I've briefly, the work di has diversified a little bit. So yeah, always I work with coiling as that's my main way of working. The round ones that you're describing, my large vessels, so they really are quite spherical, although I try not to get them absolutely spherical because that slight asymmetry, that slight looseness is what's so beautiful about hand building as opposed to throwing. The idea for me is not about getting that perfect regular shape. It's about something that has a softness to it. So the large ones are really about 45, 50 centimeters across. They're quite weighty. That's just enough for me to get my arms round. And that's even though my coils, when I start them, are about a centimeter thick. So by the time I've scraped them down to get a really beautiful finish, they're really quite thin. They're only about half a centimeter. that degree of that amount of clay is still quite heavy.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes, and they're difficult to house. But so I started, those were kind of something that I was drawn to do, and I became known for it quite quickly. But I did those in when we had COVID and lockdown, and I started this process of making one of these sort of spherical vessels that really came in with quite a small aperture, only about 7 centimeters across. So it was really quite enclosed with just this tiny, tiny lip to it, really bulbous and very present. And I made one every lunar month, and I carried that journey on throughout a 12-month, 13-month period, actually, it turned out to be, which is interesting because a lunar year is 13 full moons. So then I would create one of those, and then I would, when they were bisque fired, I would come back to them, and each one became a beautiful, voluptuous canvas, really, to kind of explore what had been happening in that month. And that might have been something that was quite internal and autobiographical, if you like, but it might be a story or something that was on the news in that time, because we were all listening to the radio and watching the news all the time because we changed so little. But it was a lovely way for me to kind of create a narrative on each surface in a very gentle and wide way. I have this lovely, lovely big surface. So yes, so they became these, each one was very much a thing in its own right, and I never quite knew how it was going to be. I would do it, I tend to work in quite an intuitive and spontaneous way. So I didn't really have an idea. But it would just come out and then be explored on the surface of the pot. I worked with those, they were all smoke fired, and smoke firing is like coiling. It's a process that I've done right from the very beginning, because my work is all about minimal, keeping it minimal. I love coiling because it's so simple. I also love it because my tool base is so simple. I have a steel kidney. I have my burnishing tool. I have two or three burnishing tools. Mainly, I just use a light bulb. That's it. And really, that's it. I've got a porcupine quill that I might put my mark in. And sometimes I'll inscribe the surfaces on that with maybe some poetry or some random words that just come in at the time when it's leather hard. So those became my moon jars, not because of a reference to the Korean moon jars. Something quite simple, yes, it was relating to the lunar month, and they just happened to be resonant in the way that the moon appears. And I really enjoy that because each one is different. Because I'm coiling and hand building, it's not measured, it's just going directly from the building and responding. The beauty of coiling, of course, is that each coil you place has a bearing on how the form manifests. Yeah, you can't go back. Each one is instrumental, and so you're making a decision each time you apply a layer, and that decision is, do I go out, do I go up, what angle? And it's as simple as that. So the moon jars are something I do keep coming back to. Because they offer me an awful, a beautiful surface, as I said, and each one can be very different in nature. And because they're large, you know, that they'll really hold that. So they'll be very, very present, and each one feels very unique. But I think I have a very sculptural approach to building, always been interested in form and shape. So even in the past, I was very drawn to standing stones and very ancient monolithic forms, which is partly why I now live in the West Country in the UK, because I've got Stonehenge in my property. So lots of those forms come through, and I enjoy that. I enjoy that because there's a discipline. It causes me to be alert to my practice. And so I'm really embedding my skills, being alert to it, and it gives me that versatility. So I kind of go between the taller monumental shapes which can relate to artifacts. I'm very interested in the humble bead, the trading bead, as being, those beautiful aesthetics of that. And arrowheads, those sort of forms come through a lot in my work. Yes, I'm probably going off at a tangent, so you might want to rein me in there, Bob, if it works.
No,
Brisbane.
this is wonderful. Love hearing you talk about your work. Could you talk a little bit? We'll talk maybe a bit about some of your new sculptural pieces that aren't round in a second. But I wonder if you could talk about your surface, because when I looked at your work, the large round forms had maybe a different kind of surface to them than some of your newer work that may have a human form to them. And so how do you finish your pieces? What's your, I don't know if you want to give your secrets away, but what's your methodology?
I'll see how I feel with that. But yes, I've already said I scrape them down. So a lot of time is spent scraping, really refining the surface. Because my marks, when I'm coiling and using my thumb to join the coils, it's quite messy. I'm not tidy. Some people are, but I'm not. But I know from my placement that my structure, my form, basic form is sound. So the refining then comes into play when I've completed the structure, and I use a metal kidney. I've got a range of metal kidneys, so I've got some variance and curve. And then I will scrape away, and I love that. I love it. That is my favorite part of the journey, the leather hard scraping. It's hard work, kills your fingers, but paring the form down so you can see its beauty and you can really see what it is just magical. Once I've completed that, I might leave it to really dry if I want, because I've got the body that I use has got a bit of grog to it, so I might really scrape it when it's very dry to get a bit more surface.
Pull that out.
Yeah, exactly. Or not. It depends how I feel. And then I'll burnish away with my light bulb. And I usually do my burnishing really quite late so that I've got some sense of the material properties of the clay coming through. I love that. So yes, all burnished. And then I leave it. So I fire to earthenware, and then I work with paper. So I use resist on my surfaces. And of course, there's so many different ways of using resist, and I could use wax, I could use latex, whatever. I have always enjoyed working with paper. And particularly because I work such a lot with clay and the softness of the clay. But when I'm working with paper and scissors and working with the qualities of the paper and tearing it or whatever I choose to do, it's quite a different thing. It's like the opposite of working with soft clay. So I like that. It becomes like a ritual process, I think. The coiling itself is so rhythmic and it's so circular. That's a very meditative process. And that's actually, I haven't mentioned it, but it's very fundamental to my enjoyment of coiling. Especially when I'm working on those big moon jars, you're working on a diameter of 50 centimeters. You are completely immersed in that process. You can't help but be. You're very alert to the state of the clay, and it's a very rhythmic, and you're in there. Your head's practically in it, because it's so big. So that becomes very stilling, and then you're in that real state of alert. And that almost, it sounds a bit whimsical, but there is that sort of transcendent element of when you are immersed in that and you are in that state and everything stops and you are so in that form in an enclosed space. So it's all, you could say that that's like an energetic envelopment of space.
It's interesting you use the word energy, because as I think, and I haven't talked to too many people about it, but I do think that there's an energy we put into our work, and that Maybe that's what you're talking about in part, that people, when they look at our work, they pick up on that energy that we put into it. In my experience with my limited work that I do, it seems like if I've got a very positive energy I'm putting into a piece, people pick up on that. And if I'm making a piece to maybe sell as opposed to what's in my heart, it may sit on the shelf a lot longer.
Oh, do you think so?
I think so. I don't have any data for that, but it's just my experience. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's definitely something to consider. I know if I go back to my days looking in the museums, is the power of objects, partly the view in those objects that are placed for ritual purposes or for ceremonial purposes. Something, whether it was intentionally put in there in the beginning, or whether it was layered up by usage, or whether it's a bit of both, does culminate in a resonant, powerful object. And that's why we visit these in wonder at museums, particularly. So there is something in that. I can't remember where I was going with that, but you got me on one of my favorite tangents there.
That's good. You were talking about coiling big pieces, and you were talking about sort of the meditative process of that, and we really do need to be in the moment when we're doing that kind of work. Can't be distracted listening or watching television or thinking about something else, because we'll lose the piece immediately. So you were talking about that, and you were talking about the energy that sometimes happens with this enclosed vessel as it becomes taller and maybe starts to close in on itself a bit.
Then you've got it harnessed. And that's an area that, to be honest, in the early days, I've been doing this practice on and off, because I took a break from it for about 10 years. But when I was young and making large pieces that became much more anthropomorphic, so they were sort of humanoid forms without intentionally being that, they just became that. It started to concern me a bit. It wasn't something that people would talk about openly. And I just thought, oh, this is energetically, it felt really quite potent. And I thought, am I going mad? So, and actually, that caused me in the end to go. I went traveling in Africa to research, to do a kind of research is perhaps a white, but I did visit lots of potters and some museums and some places where they did traditional medicine, to ask them and witness how they were using clay as a spiritual material in their practices. And it was really interesting. So engaging with potters out there who would just, as a matter of course, just say, well, of course I work with clay, and because I am clay, and they totally understood all this language of that kind of potency and that sort of energetic holding that clay can do, because it's a material that, particularly, I only ever fire my work to earthenware because I need the clay to breathe. That's why I've normally done smoke firing. I don't like to glaze my work, because the clay is sort of semi-alive thing. So I feel like that needs to be respected, and for it to enable it to breathe and to continue to have a life and a resonance. You're getting all this stuff out of me.
Hey, let's finish off talking about some of your newer work, which is the sculptural work, which is certainly different than the round vessel forms that you are making. Tell us about what that's about for you.
I think I've allowed myself to follow authentically what the forms that need to come out of my fingers in the moment. And I know, as I said before, I was drawn to this part of the world and the standing stones and those kind of monoliths, and they're present everywhere in different cultures in different ways. I was blessed to go to Orkney, right off the tip of the UK, where there's lots of amazing Neolithic structures there and a few standing stones. And of course, The standing stones and the circles, the circles in the UK particularly, they have different natures. They're not all the same, and they're different structures, and a lot of them have that very human form to them. So it's an extension of that small artifact and what we have used in humanity, what the objects we've chosen to bury in. There is something powerful about those structures, and I think it was just my way of wanting to key into that a little bit and explore it and put, what does it. So obviously those are stone structures, but if I just thought if I start to immerse myself in building this structure, given what we were just talking about with that kind of internal shape being kind of enclosed in it, can you create something that has that kind of similar energetic statuesque quality? It's a kind of, it's just a paying homage to those traditions, I think, and that alertness to the power of shape and form to suggest things that aren't quite tangible, but there we have a sense of knowing and of familiarity, and there's a certain sense of it, the shape calling us to a kind of centering. I don't know what that's all about, but I know I enjoy working with the structure to create those shapes. It's just a beautiful thing to do.
Hey, it was wonderful talking with you today. This has been fantastic. I always ask our guests if they have a bit of advice for somebody who might be new into the game of clay. Have you got any thoughts about a bit of advice for somebody who's new into clay or a more junior into that work?
You know, I think a few things are coming to mind. I think be open. And I think there's a tendency to go in feeling, especially I see that, I witness it at the moment, there's a huge tick list of things to do in ceramics, particularly. There are so many techniques, there are so many clay bodies, there are so many approaches. It's not necessary. You don't need to do all of them. All you need to do is enjoy it and find something that you like doing and then see where it takes you.
Paying attention to what you like as opposed to what you think somebody else might like is really the key, eh?
Totally.
Yes. Jane, thank you so much for being here today. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. I, of course, will put your website and Instagram and all those kind of things on our information and get it out there. So thank you so much.
That's so kind, and thank you, Bob. Been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.